Have you ever found yourself wondering if there's like a blueprint for a perfect way to live, or maybe a truly ideal society? What if the answers were explored, I don't know, over two millennia ago by one of history's greatest minds in a work that still echoes today?
It's a fascinating thought, isn't it?
It really is. Today, we're taking a deep dive into precisely that, Plato's The Republic. It's a work that asks the ultimate timeless question. What exactly is justice?
Yeah, and our mission today for you, our listener, is to unpack this monumental text.
Right.
We'll distill its core arguments, try to understand its historical heartbeat, and crucially, reveal why its insights are still surprisingly relevant to your life and the societies we navigate every day.
So we've sifted through the key sources, the summaries.
Yes, aiming to bring you the really essential nuggets of knowledge.
Okay, let's start at the beginning then.
Mm-hmm.
Who was Plato? He wasn't just some, you know, ivory tower academic, was he?
No, not at all. He was born into an aristocratic Athenian family, lived through some seriously turbulent times.
Politically charged years, I understand, like the Peloponnesian War.
Exactly. Devastating conflict. But there was one event that really propelled him, right, into this quest for justice.
Ah, you mean Socrates?
Absolutely. The single most profoundly shaping event for Plato was the execution of his mentor, Socrates. By the Athenian democracy, no less.
Wow.
And what's fascinating here is that Plato's diverse experiences, his traditional Greek education, his travels, you know, studying various political systems.
He even tried advising a ruler in Sicily, didn't he? Didn't go so well, I heard.
Huh? No, it didn't. But all these things uniquely positioned him. Yet Socrates' death wasn't just personal loss. It cemented his belief in the dangers of, let's say, unchecked democracy.
Okay.
And it spurred his lifelong search for a more just, more stable form of governance, one based on wisdom, not just popular opinion.
It's almost like he felt he had to prove Socrates' accusers wrong, show what real justice was.
You could definitely see it that way. Show what true justice and knowledge really entail.
So the Republic itself, then, it wasn't just a dry political tract. It's written as a dialogue, almost like a play.
Exactly. Often with Socrates as the main character, it sets out to define justice, sure, but then it just expands.
Spirals out.
Yeah, into this incredibly comprehensive blueprint. For human society, for individual development, it really stretches quite far.
How far are we talking?
Well, connecting to the bigger picture, it covers everything from education, censorship, even the nature of reality itself.
Really?
The book's overarching goal is, well, incredibly ambitious. It challenges you to think critically about the society you inhabit and the principles guiding your own life.
So it's a thought experiment.
Fundamentally, yes. A philosophical thought experiment. Building a perfect society in speech, as he puts it.
Not necessarily a practical plan.
Maybe not practical in the everyday sense, but as a magnified model. The idea is, by seeing justice writ large in a state, well, then we can better understand the workings of the individual human soul.
Okay, that makes sense. So this idea of justice, it isn't just about external actions like following rules.
Yo, it's deeper. Inner harmony for the soul and reflected in the state.
And Plato argues that a truly just life is actually the happiest life, intrinsically happy.
That's the core argument.
Yeah.
But defining justice, well, that isn't easy, is it? The dialogue starts with some pretty common sense ideas.
Right. In book one, where does it start? A party.
Of all places. An elderly businessman, Cephalus, offers a conventional definition. Justice is simply telling the truth and paying one's debts.
Okay. Seems reasonable.
Then his son, Polemarchus, chimes in, suggests it's about helping friends and harming enemies. Also seems pretty straightforward, right? For everyday life.
Yeah, that sounds familiar. But Socrates, he's the critical thinker. He always digs deeper, doesn't he? How does he start poking holes in these?
Well, he quickly shows they're inadequate. Uses counterexamples that expose the flaws.
Like what?
For instance, should you return a weapon to a madman just because you owe it to him? Suddenly, Cephalus's definition seems, well, dangerous.
Hmm. Yeah. Not so simple.
And Polemarchus's idea, harming enemies. Socrates argues justice can't produce injustice. It must always aim for good.
So harming someone makes them worse, less just.
Exactly. So that can't be what justice is really about.
Okay, so these common sense ideas kind of fall apart under scrutiny. What presents the real challenge then? The one that forces Socrates to, you know, rethink everything?
Ah, that's where Thrasymachus comes in. A provocative sophist.
The antagonist.
You could say that. He throws down the gauntlet with this really cynical assertion. Justice is simply the advantage of the stronger.
Oof. That makes right.
Basically. He argues morality is just a tool, rules that rulers create to maintain their power, control their subjects.
Wow. That's a profoundly cynical view. How does Socrates even begin to tackle that? Because if Thrasymachus is right, why bother being just at all?
And this is crucial. Thrasymachus's claim forces Socrates to prove justice is intrinsically valuable, good in itself.
Not just useful for, like, avoiding punishment or getting a good reputation.
Exactly. Not just instrumentally useful. It has to be good for its own sake. And this lays the groundwork for the entire rest of the deep dive. It compels Socrates to build this comprehensive defense of justice.
Going way beyond just refuting arguments.
Way beyond. He has to construct a whole new way of understanding it.
And that challenge from Thrasymachus, it really sticks with Plato's brothers Glaucon and Adeimantus. They join the conversation too.
They do, and they aren't satisfied with Socrates just shutting Thrasymachus down. They want him to prove justice is good in itself.
Right, and Glaucon brings up that famous thought experiment, the Ring of Gages.
Ah, yes, the invisibility ring.
It's such a powerful image. If you had a ring that made you invisible, could act unjustly without any consequences, nobody knowing, would you still choose to be just?
It's a profound question about human nature, isn't it? It really cuts to the core.
Absolutely. So how does Socrates respond to that challenge?
Well, this is where we see a fascinating methodological shift. He proposes examining justice writ large first.
In a state, before looking at the individual soul.
Exactly, the city soul analogy. That becomes the backbone of the whole work.
So by constructing an ideal state, he creates a magnified image.
Precisely. Making complex psychological, ethical concepts more tangible, easier to see the big picture first, then apply it to the individual.
Okay. So he starts building this ideal city, this Kallipolis.
Yep.
What are the main parts?
He outlines three main classes. First, the producers, farmers, artisans, the economic engine.
Makes sense.
Then the guardians, the warriors, defenders of the state.
Okay.
And finally, the rulers. And for Plato, these must be the philosopher kings.
Ah, the philosopher kings. We'll get to them. But this guardian class, their lives sound pretty radical.
Oh, they are. Their education is incredibly strict, controlled, even involves censorship of poetry and music.
Censorship? Why?
To shape their character. Foster a deep love of truth, beauty, order, mold them into virtuous protectors.
And then there's the noble lie.
Yes, the myth of the metals, a founding myth told to all citizens.
What's the gist?
That everyone's born from the earth with different metals mixed into their souls, gold for rulers, silver for guardians, bronze or iron for producers.
And the point of this lie.
To ensure social cohesion.
Yeah.
To help people accept their roles in society, feel a sense of shared origin and purpose.
Hold on, a noble lie? That sounds problematic. How can a lie be noble, especially as a foundation? And censorship?
Yeah.
That feels pretty authoritarian to modern ears.
It's definitely one of the Republic's most debated, most controversial ideas, no question.
So how did Plato justify it?
He argues it's noble because its intent is good, fostering unity, stability, preventing chaos. It's a shared story for the common good.
Mm.
The censorship, too, is aimed at cultivating virtue, not just suppressing ideas randomly. But yes, it immediately raises huge ethical flags for us today about state control, belief shaping, artistic freedom.
Even with good intentions.
Even with what Plato saw as good intentions. And perhaps even more controversially, for the guardians, he proposes the abolition of private property and family.
Whoa. No personal property, no families. For the guardians, that's extreme. What was the purpose there?
The purpose was total dedication to the state. Eliminate private interests entirely.
So no distractions, no competing loyalties.
Exactly. Plato believed if guardians had no personal wealth, no family ties, their loans preventing corruption.
That's a commitment. But then he also says something pretty radical in the other direction, right? About women.
He does, and this is quite startling for his time. He advocates for the equality of women within the guardian class, in education, in roles, argues their capacities are fundamentally the same as men's.
That is incredibly forward-thinking. Okay, so he builds this whole city structure, but how does it connect back to the individual soul?
Right, that's the key connection in Book 4. He shows how the city's main virtues.
Wisdom, courage, temperance, justice.
Exactly. Those four cardinal virtues, they parallel the three parts of the individual soul. Reason, the calculating part, spirit, the honor-loving, emotional part, and appetite, the desiring part for food, drink, money, sex, etc.
So individual justice is when these parts are balanced.
Precisely. When reason rules, guided by wisdom, When spirit acts bravely in support of reason, and when the appetites are kept in check, tempered, when these three parts of your soul are properly ordered, each doing its job,
then you achieve a just soul.
A just soul.
Yeah.
Which Plato equates with psychological health and ultimately true happiness. It's all about that inner balance.
Okay. And this leads us to his most famous, maybe most controversial political idea, the Philosopher King, in books 5th and 6th.
That's the one. His famous line, until philosophers become kings, or kings take up philosophy, cities will never have rest from their evils.
Why was this so essential for Plato? It sounds, I don't know, a bit utopian, maybe even dictatorial.
It's essential because, for Plato, only those who truly love wisdom, who understand eternal truths, what he calls the forms, are fit to govern.
The forms? What are those exactly? Like blueprint?
Sort of, yeah. Think of them as the perfect, unchanging essences of things. The ideal form of beauty, the form of justice. The ultimate reality behind the imperfect things we see,
and above them all,
is the form of the good, the ultimate source of all reality, all knowledge, like the sun illuminating everything else.
Oh, okay.
So philosopher kings, having grasped these truths, especially the form of the good, are free from personal gain or swaying to popular opinion. They grasp ultimate reality.
So they rule out of duty. Not for power.
Exactly. Aiming for the good of the whole society based on true knowledge.
Okay, so these forms are like the ultimate reality, beyond just what we perceive. To help us grasp this, Plato gives us his most famous metaphor, the allegory of the cave, book 7.
Such a powerful image. Prisoners chained in a cave their whole lives.
Facing a wall, yeah. Watching only shadows cast by puppets behind them.
And they mistake these shadows for reality itself. Because it's all they've ever known.
Which raises that crucial question for you, the listener. How do you perceive reality? What are your shadows?
It really does. The allegory unpacks that painful journey. From ignorance, the shadows, to enlightenment, knowledge.
Which is getting out of the cave into the real world.
Into the true world illuminated by the sun, which symbolizes that form of the good.
But the journey isn't easy.
Mm.
And the philosopher who escapes, they have a duty to go back, right?
Yes, a duty to return to the cave, to try and educate the others, free them from their illusions.
Even though they'll likely resist, maybe even violently,
mm-hmm.
because people cling to their familiar shadow.
Precisely. It highlights the difficulty of challenging deeply ingrained beliefs, of convincing others to look beyond appearances. It asks you to question your own perceptions.
Okay, so that's the ideal. But what happens when this system, this Kallipolis, inevitably breaks down? Plato talks about the decay of societies in Book 8, doesn't he?
He does. He maps out this theory of political degeneration, how even the best states corrupt over time.
How does it progress?
It starts with his ideal state, the aristocracy ruled by philosopher kings.
Yeah.
That decays into a democracy ruled by the honor-loving military types.
Okay.
Then oligarchy ruled by the wealthy, which then devolves into democracy rule characterized by freedom and appetite.
And finally?
Finally, tyranny, the worst form arising from the chaos of democracy.
And each state corresponds to a type of individual soul.
Exactly. The dominant part of the soul mirrors the ruling principle of the state. It's fascinating how he links the political and the psychological.
And he's quite critical of democracy, isn't he? Seeing its excessive freedom as leading to chaos.
He is. He worries that when all desires are treated as equal, it leads to disorder, making society vulnerable to a demagogue who promises stability but delivers tyranny. A potent warning.
And the tyrannical individual themselves, in Book 9, they seem powerful, but Plato says they're actually the most miserable.
The most miserable, yes. Utterly enslaved by their own lawless appetites. A prisoner of desire, constantly fearful, never satisfied.
So ultimately, Plato defends justice. How does he finally prove it's better than injustice?
He offers three main proofs, really circling back to answer Glaucon's original challenge. He argues the philosopher's life, guided by reason, brings the truest, most stable pleasures.
Not like the fleeting pleasures of appetite.
Exactly. Those are more like shadows of pleasure. He also uses mathematical arguments about the degrees of pleasure, ultimately concluding the just life is vastly happier than the unjust life, especially the tyrants.
And he ends the whole thing with a myth.
Yes, the myth of Ur in Book X, a vision of the afterlife. Souls are judged, experience rewards or punishments, and then choose their next lives.
And their choices reflect their character.
Critically, yes. Those who live justly tend to choose wisely. Those who were unjust often choose poorly, perpetuating cycles. It reinforces the eternal importance of cultivating a just soul now.
Wow. Okay, what an incredible journey and so many connections to our lives today. For you, the listener, Let's talk about educational reform and character development.
Yeah, Plato's idea of holistic education. It wasn't just about facts, was it?
No, it was about cultivating virtue, critical thinking, shaping the whole person.
And the insight there for you today is maybe thinking about all the influences shaping young minds, not just school, but media, culture, peers.
Right. It's all part of their curriculum in a way, affecting who they become.
Exactly. It challenges parents, educators, maybe all of us to be more mindful of those character shaping forces.
Then there's leadership development, the philosopher king idea. Maybe not literally, but as a metaphor.
As a metaphor, yeah. It pushes us to value wisdom, ethical judgment, genuine expertise, commitment to the common good.
Over just charisma or ambition.
Yeah.
Or loudness.
Right. Plato challenges us. When you choose leaders in politics, at work, in your community, are you prioritizing that deep knowledge and ethical grounding, even if it's less flashy?
A good question. And for personal development, that tripartite soul model, reason, spirit, appetite, seems like a really useful framework for self-reflection.
It really is. For your own life, Plato urges that self-examination. What's driving your decisions? Is it rational thought? Is it honor, ambition, maybe righteous anger? Or is it immediate cravings, desires?
And the goal is harmony, reason guiding the others.
Cultivating that personal harmony, yeah. Reason guiding spirit, managing appetites, that internal justice he talked about, leading to psychological health.
Finally, his ideas offer a lens for critiquing society and media. His warnings about democracy's potential pitfalls, the power of art or stories to manipulate, feels very relevant now.
Incredibly relevant. The striking lesson for you is to actively question the stories your culture tells you through news, social media, entertainment.
How do they shape your desires, your understanding of what's real or important?
Exactly. Are you sometimes mistaking shadows for substance, like the prisoners in the cave? It's a call to seek genuine understanding, critically engage, not just passively consume. You know, Plato's Republic, it wasn't just some abstract political blueprint. It was this profound argument for the link, the inseparable link between justice, virtue, and ultimately true happiness.
So maybe a final thought for you to consider. If justice really is the health and harmony of the soul, what single small step could you take today, right now, to bring a little more of that internal order into your own life?
And what might that mean ripples outward for the larger society we all share?
Exactly.
A deep dive like this really shows us that the biggest questions, well, they're often the oldest ones, aren't they? Still waiting for us to engage with them right here, right now. We hope this exploration has given you a shortcut to being well-informed and maybe sparked some profound reflections.